From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last week, the Bush administration finally took sides in a knockdown, drag-out fight that's been raging for 8 years in the telecommunications industry. On one side of the struggle are AT&T, MCI, and a host of other long-distance providers trying to gain a foothold in the lucrative local phone market. On the other side are the baby bells, the phone companies who control 80% of the local market and who resent the discounts Congress requires them to give competitors who pay to use their networks. The bells have spent the last 8 years protesting the cut rates, arguing that the discounts are so steep they end up subsidizing the long-distance guys trying to go local. Last Wednesday, the Bush administration made the unusual decision not to defend federal policy, announcing that it would not appeal a district court ruling that in March gutted the so-called reduced access fees. Later that same day, the FCC reversed course and dropped its own appeal. Now, higher rates for telephone users are a virtual certainty, and consumer advocates are crying foul, calling the Bush administration's decision a sop to big-dollar campaign contributors. Tonight on Point, the revenge of the baby bells, higher rates, competition, and where consumer interests lie now. Who's on your side in the battle over the telephone universe? The baby bells, the cell phone companies, the government, anybody? Who's watching out for the consumer in the battle over telephone profits? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Chris Stern, a staff writer for The Washington Post, who's been covering the story. Good evening and welcome, Chris Stern. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris, we want you to take us into what's happened in the last week, but if you would, step back with us for a moment first to look at the big picture in telephones. So many options appear to be blossoming here. Regular old-fashioned telephone service with hard lines, cell phones, computer or internet telephony, even cable companies getting into the telephone business. You cover this. When people in the industry look 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, where is telephone service headed?
Well, it's definitely heading on to the internet. Excuse me. And that is something that it's at work here. And under all of this, this expectation that the government has that they don't have to worry about competition, subsidizing competition, because technological innovation and new entrants are going to spur more competition and drive prices down for consumers.
As far as I know, it's only a few tens of thousands of Americans who use internet telephony currently. How does that work? How would it work in the future? Will it be just like using a telephone? Am I going to have to sit down at my PC to call up grandma in, Omaha?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There's not a whole lot of competition. One of the things that proponents of the baby bell view of the universe point to is the fact that cable, which is a big, huge, deep-pocketed industry, is about to get into the telecommunications business with their own brand of phone service. But the fact is, less than 3 million people or 3 million telephone lines it's actually about 2.8 million telephone lines are now served by cable companies. And there's a long way to go, because if you look at the entire universe of telephone lines, there's about 188 million of them when you count in the offices and extra lines and homes and stuff like that. So there really is a long way to go.
Let me just ask you, you jumped right to cable there. I'm really a novice in this. Are cable phone service and internet phone service the same thing? Are they related?
They're related. The cable companies have been thinking about getting into phone service for a long time, because it's they have a wire, and they've got a wire into that passes virtually every house in America, and
right.
That goes into about 85% of them. And so once you have a wire into a house, you have a lot of options you can provide. You can provide video, your traditional cable service. You can provide high-speed internet service, which is it's proved to be an incredibly profitable business for the cable companies. Mm-hmm. And now they're thinking about this complicated business of providing telephone lines, something that the big cable companies have resisted for a long time. But now that they've developed this internet telephone service called VoIP, for Voice Over Internet Protocol. Mm-hmm. But now that they've developed that, they feel like they've hit the turning point and that they can now start launching this. Comcast, the nation's largest cable company, is doing 3 market trials, is going to have the technology available to 95% of its customers by the end of the year. But they're not quite convinced. They're just saying it's available. They're not saying they're going to launch it yet.
Let me ask some simple questions. If cable succeeds in pushing this internet telephone service to consumers, number one, will it just plug in to the telephone I have now?
Yeah, you'll be able to use your phone that you have in your house. You won't have to buy any new equipment. You'll have to buy some new equipment, but it's not going to be a new phone. We should talk about some of the other varieties of internet phone service there are, though. Vonage, which is a company that does a similar thing to cable, provides internet service over a high-speed line. It's a very similar technology. There's other companies that provide you attach something to your computer, and you can talk to other people with similar technology.
So this is like Vonage, Net2 Phone, i2 Telecom.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're seeing at the beginning of what we're thinking about in 1998, there's all these opportunities in the internet world. Well, now that's all come to the phone business.
And I guess I misspoke earlier. It's tens of thousands a month of Americans who are turning to this internet telephony.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite sure on the numbers, but we're definitely south of a million still.
Okay, so how is this likely then to collide or to converge with the telephone industry as we have known it?
Well, what you're seeing is the baby bells have had a control of the phone system for 100 years. Mm-hmm. And now we have, for the first time in history, an opportunity for people to get around that traditional phone network. And for the last 3 years, we've seen, for the first time in history, the number of telephone lines served by the baby bells drop. But a huge percent of that drop and the number of lines they serve came from the AT&Ts and MCIs, these big established phone companies that were using the regulatory regime that got tossed last week to provide discounted service to consumers.
Now we get into the current debate, and this grew out of the 1996 telecommunications bill.
Right, and the basic tenet of the Telecom Act was the idea that the long-distance guys were on one side of the sheet and the local companies were on another side, and it was time, in order to build competition in both their businesses, for them to start competing against each other.
And to encourage that, they required that the baby bells give a discounted rate to the long-distance companies for what, Chris Stern?
What they wanted to do, what Congress was hoping to do, was that if this discounted rate would allow long-distance companies and other companies to get into the business, get a toehold, and then start investing in their own equipment and launching their own networks and providing their own services.
A toehold in long-distance, in local, in both?
A toehold. Well, let's just step back for a second and describe what actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is the local companies had no problem getting into long distance. It's been a huge success for them because, think about it, they have that direct contact with the consumer. It's already established. They call you up and they say, look, we provide your local service. How would you like long distance for a package price of $50 a month?
So this is Verizon, Bell South, SBC Communications.
Yeah. And they take out full page ads in the newspaper, and it's a no-brainer. You're comfortable with Verizon. And so you sign up for their long distance package.
Okay.
And in places like New York, they now have Verizon has 60% of the market. Verizon's now the third largest long distance provider in the country. I actually think it's the second. They're second to AT&T. MCI won't give me their numbers yet, but I really think Verizon is now the second largest long distance provider in the country.
So the locals have boomed into long distance. What about the long distance providers who were supposed to come in and create competition at the local level?
What's happened is they've really become stranded, and they haven't had that same kind of success because for some reason the people are not as comfortable with getting their long distance provider to provide their local business. And also it's more complicated because Verizon does control that local network, and there's been a lot of back and forth about how good the local companies have been at playing with their competitors. If I call up Verizon and say I want to switch to another provider, there's a long history at the FCC that battled in courts over. Verizon draws out the process, makes it very slow.
You're not going to make it easy
for 4 days,
right?
Yeah.
Why did the Bush administration last week say, all right, we'll stop these discounted rates to the long-distance providers? Bells, over to you. If the bells are prospering already, why this step?
The basic thought of the Federal Communications Commission and the White House was that there's now enough competition in the marketplace. It's got enough of a toehold that we can pull off the regulations that we've imposed on them. They also believe that there's enough what they call facility space, which are people who own their own networks to compete with the local bell companies.
Okay.
And, you know, AT&T is not a facility-based company because it has to rent the network from Verizon, whereas a cable company actually owns its own network. It doesn't need much from Verizon to offer you the service. If you talk to AT&T, MTI, and consumer advocates, they say the move was way too premature.
Let's talk to a consumer advocate right now, see what that perspective brings to the conversation. Chris Stern, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Mark Cooper. He is Research Director for the Consumer Federation of America. Mark Cooper, good evening and welcome.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. What do you think of what has transpired in the last week around telephone service? Who's it good for? Is it good for the consumer?
No, it's not good for the consumer. I mean, Chris has sort of put it in the exact proper context. The development of local competition is almost entirely related to the renting of the piece parts of the monopoly network, a 100-year-old monopoly.
AT&T and MCI coming in and rent from the bells.
Renting access to the central offices,
okay.
to the wires, and able to then add some of their own switching. And basically they are, in the last couple of years, they gained about 20 million customers, even less in the residential market. They were getting a toehold, and the bells were let into long distance. As Chris has pointed out, it was very easy for the bells to get into long distance, very hard for the long distance company to get into local. And so it had just started. And
so why do you think this change has been made? Why has the government let go of this whole big policy?
Politics. Let's be clear, and all of the press has made it clear, the baby bells have lobbied the White House to the extreme, they won the political lobbying war. This is a reward to their major constituencies, which is the largest corporations. Consumers and all the little competitors do not have the clout with the Bush administration to carry the day. Remember, the commission voted in favor of looking at it very carefully, moving market by market, and the bells objected, and they leaned on the White House, and the White House sided with the three biggest companies at the expense of everybody else.
So, Mark Cooper, you're at the Consumer Federation of America. What do you think it's going to mean for telephone bills that start showing up in Americans' mailboxes, and when?
Well, about 50 million people have switched to bundles of local and long-distance services. The baby bells never offered those until these competitors got into the market. They will slowly eliminate the competition. They are going to withhold the access to the network. They've made that clear. I've actually reading some of the letters they sent to competitors already. And so over time, that level of competition will disappear.
And rates?
And bills will go up.
By how much and when?
Well, if you have switched, if you are being served by a bundle, you are saving $10 to $15 a month, and over time, that will go away. The long-distance companies, the competitors will exit the market. Their customers will migrate back. The bells will stop offering their bundles. And so it will be over time, but the outcome, given the decision of the administration, is clear. That kind of competition will disappear. We don't believe that the competition from cable companies will discipline the baby bells, just like competition from satellite doesn't discipline the cable companies in their video packages.
But none of this will happen until after the November election, am I right?
That was a part of the political contribution. Let's be clear. A remarkable set of letters, personal letters from the companies to the chairman and the members of the commission, promising not to raise rates until after the election. That was the deal. There are press accounts of meetings at the White House in which the chairman was told, you better guarantee that nothing happens before the election. That's what has made this so incredibly political, tied directly to the election.
We've got a lot we want to figure out here tonight. Chris Stern, I hear you there. We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back and get your perspective on what this does to competition, what it may do to rates. We're talking tonight about the revenge of the baby bells, about phone rates headed up, and where consumer interests lie now. You can join the conversation. Who's on your side in the battle over telephone logistics and rates? The baby bells, the cell phone companies, the government, anybody? Where have your telephone loyalties migrated? Are you being well cared for? Are your nickel-a-minute long-distance bargains about to be offset by ballooning local rates? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the revenge of the baby bells, phone rates headed up, and where consumer interests lie now. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you see real competition in your local phone market? Are cell phones and internet calling already real competitors to the baby bells' landlines? And who was done a favor by the government's decision last week? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking with Chris Stern, Washington Post staff reporter who covers this whole story and this whole industry. Also from Washington, Mark Cooper, research director at the Consumer Federation of America. Joining us now from Denver, Colorado, is Ray Gifford. He's president of the Progress and Freedom Foundation, a think tank founded in 1993 by a protege of Newt Gingrich, funded in part, I must say, looking down the list here, by Baby Bells. He's former chairman of the Colorado Public Utilities Commission. Good evening and welcome, Ray Gifford.
Good evening.
So, Ray Gifford, thanks for being with us. What do you make of last week's decision and what it means for the future of competition in the telephone industry, for the future of rates in the industry?
Well, I think it was a very an overdue move, and I think consumers will long-term see benefits from it. We had had, since the 1996 Telecom Act, a regulatory war of attrition over access to the incumbent's phone network. And we'd also had three failed attempts by the FCC justify its unbundling mandate, which is the mandate that you were talking about with Mark, where the incumbent phone companies were required to share their networks with newcomers.
But explain to us some of the lingo. We may not have time to unbundle ourselves, but just at bottom, why is it better for consumers if these long-distance companies are put in a less advantageous position to compete with the local bells?
Well, it all has to do with what competition is for and how competition benefits consumers.
Well, let's say it's for lower rates and better service.
Well, lower rates and better service. Now, you have a peculiar situation with phone rates where most of them in most states had been held for residences below the actual cost it was to serve.
Does that mean the bells are losing money?
Yes, in many states. It depends on where, but the legacy phone pricing system was really a vast cross-subsidy mechanism where you held business rates and long-distance rates high to subsidize low residential and low rural rates. And so you had a very messed up pricing system, and into that is what the 96 Act and the FCC's unbundling rules came
right
into. And by them starting to go away, and that's one important thing that I think all people should understand, is that the decision last week to not appeal the D.C. Circuit's decision
right
to the Supreme Court does not eliminate all the unbundling rules the FCC is working right now on interim rules to keep some unbundling in place. And I think most people agree that for some period of time you want to have at least the local loop unbundled so competitors can get access to the end-use consumer.
Chris Stern, step in here for a moment. We've got Mark Cooper at the Consumers Federation saying this is bad for consumers. Ray Gifford, in no small part funded by Baby Bell, saying, no, it's good. What's your view? What are you hearing?
I think what we're talking about is a difference in time frame, in short term versus long term. In the long term, it may be better for consumers.
Why?
To have companies competing who own their different networks. If Company A owns a network that competes and is even slightly better than Verizon's network, that may be better for consumers because Verizon will want to upgrade its network to compete with Company A.
Now, in the past, nobody could afford to come in and put those lines down, but you're really talking about the cable companies then and internet telephony in the future, longer term?
Yeah, but I think that's still a long way away. It's certainly not the current situation. The other thing I wanted to point out is rates are going to go up. We might see rate increases announced as early as this week. We're going to see some of the major long-distance companies announce possibly this week that they're getting out of certain markets because they don't know what they're going to be charged by the bells in the coming months. The Bush administration is hoping, and their chief telephone administrator today, communicator, a guy at the Commerce Department said today that he wants to put off rates increases for as long as possible. And I don't think that should be any surprise as why they want to put off those rate increases.
But if long distance companies are getting out of markets, Chris, that does not sound like more competition.
That's what I'm saying. In the short term, it sounds it's probably going to be rate hikes for consumers. So the difference between Mark and Ray is the difference between timing reference. Competitors might emerge, but it hasn't happened yet.
Depends on the time horizon. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Jeremy's calling from Platteville, Wisconsin. Hi, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I actually work at a local telephone. Actually, at an CLEC. Excuse me. And not only do I see a big problem with what the FCC did last week and what the president did last week, but for any CLEC to go out and work on an ILEC, and an ILEC is just the local telephone company, and I would be a long-distance company.
So you're the long-distance provider,
yeah,
and you have to interact with the local baby bells. Okay, how's it work?
And actually for us to even get a line installed as a long-distance provider at the moment, we have to send out two texts. We need to not only send out one of the baby bell texts, but also one of ours. So the baby bells are making money no matter what they're looking at.
So if they can raise their rates, what does it do to your business, Jeremy?
I mean, well, all they have to do is, you know, take an extra hour and a extra day sometimes, you know, go out and test lines, and that reflects very badly on us. And we've had a little bit of control over that, and I see with the gutting of these regulations, you know, they're just going to have an even more larger incentive to do things like that.
Jeremy, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Mark Cooper, Jeremy works for a long-distance provider. He says it's already difficult for them to compete, and any consumer who's interacted with this tangled junction knows that. I guess this speaks to your perspective, that it's not going to be any easier or any cheaper when those rates can go up.
Well, the baby bells made it difficult, if not impossible. I actually participated in more of these proceedings than almost anybody in the country. But let me make another point, and because Ray says, well, if you look to the long term, we'll have a lot of facilities-based competition. The simple fact, you know, and once we get rid of all these people trying to use the existing networks, we'll get down to real, quote, facilities-based competition.
And again, for clarity, I guess you mean, or he means by that, cable companies with internet phone service.
Yeah, and the answer is that there are two wires going into the home today. There may be another one later, but the two dominant wires, the cable wire and the telephone wire, for internet service that you need their high-speed service.
Right.
And neither of those wires will be open to let competition flow. The FCC has approached these two wires by saying those are not subject to making themselves available. And so what we're relegated to is competition between two guys who control their networks, who have market power in one or the other services, and that is, it's called a duopoly. It's better than a monopoly, but it's not real competition.
But isn't that inevitable? Because somebody's going to own the wire.
Absolutely not inevitable. That's exactly the point.
Back in 1907, I'm looking here, AT&T president said in 1907 that the telephone was, by nature of its technology, would operate most efficiently as a monopoly, providing universal service.
He agreed in that statement, the famous Kingsbury commitment, to open his network, to interoperate, to let everything flow. The current Federal Communications Commission has repealed exactly those commitments to run an open network for both the cable operators who are providing telecommunication services and the local companies. And that's really the long-term radical change that eliminates all obligations for non-discriminatory access to the telecommunications network.
So you're saying monopoly to duopoly, and we still don't get full competition going on.
Two's not enough for competition. The Justice Department used to say six is enough. Some of us think 10 is what you need, but two is not. It's an ugly duopoly where people, the baby bells, for instance, today, if you call up and order their high-speed internet service, their DSL service, they insist you take their voice service. They won't let you buy DSL without buying voice.
Talk about bundling. I want to get another call here, Mark Cooper. Fred is calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I wanted to point out that if people think that the internet is going to solve their telephone competition problem, they aren't. They're going to be disappointed.
Now, why is that? Because of this duopoly argument that Mark Cooper's making?
That's right. Partially, it's the duopoly, but you have to look at it at two different levels. When you buy internet service today, there are actually two products being sold.
Mm-hmm.
The internet service comes from an ISP, an internet service provider,
right,
which is an unregulated company. Then there's the wire that the ISP runs on.
Mm-hmm.
You might be dialing up the ISP across your local phone company, or you may be getting DSL,
right,
in which case the ISP is buying service from someone.
Right.
Now, as it stands now, DSL is competitive. And so you can go to your local ISP, and they might be able to get service from the local Bell company, that is the raw wire service from the Bell company as a DSL, or they may go to a company like, say, Covad, a competitive local provider of DSL. And these companies sell wholesale service to ISPs. Under the FCC's current plan, envisioned, independent CLECs like COVAD lose their low-cost access to the wire to the home.
So there's still the wire involved, even in the internet system, and you're saying this new move takes away the discount rate on that.
Exactly. It means the question of discount is not exactly appropriate. It takes away the cost-based rate, because the idea of the Telecom Act was that competitors would have access to all of these so-called unbundled network elements at a price that's based on cost.
And have some real competition. Fred, it sounds like you know this well. What's your bottom line assessment? What's going on here with this latest move?
Well, it is a power play by the Bells. In the very short term, it creates a lot of regulatory uncertainty, which prevents investors from investing in the competitive telecommunications segment. What it does is really shut off investment and also cause a lot of weaker competitors to go out of business or shut down or not expand their networks.
Fred, let me put that to Ray Gifford in Denver. Ray, here's it sounds like a pretty well clued in guy who says this doesn't look like more competition to him. It looks like less.
Well, I think what it's going to spur is a specific and beneficial kind of competition, and that's the competition that's going to benefit consumers.
And that being?
Which is facilities-based competition.
But is that the duopoly that Chris Stern described here, or Mark Cooper?
Well, first of all, I think Mark forgot one of the other paths into the home, which is the spectrum and the wireless platform that is available currently for voice telephony, where you have
cell phones,
six going to five national wireless providers. And you're on the verge of new technologies like WiMAX and ultra wideband, which would provide high speed broadband wireless.
Are you suggesting that's going to be just as big an avenue into the home as the cable wire or the telephone wire?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And there are very big bets being made right now by major corporations than it would be.
Mark Cooper, let me put that to you. Do you see wireless cell phone service as a real competitor here that can open up the field?
Well, wireless today costs about five times as much as basic local telephone service, so it's not a competitor today. It remains to be seen whether or not we get access to the spectrum in a fashion that will support this competition. But that's the fundamental problem with Ray's hypothesis, is that what we're having here is we're deregulating the market long before there's effective competition, on the hope that we might get enough competition sometime in the future. And the problem is that if that competition doesn't arrive, and we in the near term we're going to pay more, and in the long term we get this huge battle with entrenched incumbents who resist getting real competition. So essentially Ray's point is that, you know, Mark, we might have six paths into the home in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and my problem is that when it doesn't materialize, I still can't get Ray to give me relief from the abuse of market power.
Which makes it look like a power play today to you. Val's calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hi, Val. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, a couple of comments.
Yeah.
I am in this country for 6 years by now.
Okay.
I can tell you that my phone bill went from in 98 for about $200 a month to about probably 40, including all the international calling.
You're a genius. How'd you do it, Val?
Now, how do you do it? It's first of all, right now I'm finally using the voice over IP service from Vonage that you mentioned before.
Right.
And I believe it's unbelievable offer to the consumer. You want to have internet at home anyway, so.
So this is internet telephone over your cable modem, and does it work well? And what's it cost? Obviously, your costs are going down.
it works perfect. And, you know, for $29 a month, you basically have unlimited calling plan for the entire North America.
And, Val, are you confident that the Internet will continue to bring you those low rates? We're hearing here tonight that as this thing goes forward, they're likely to go up.
Well, I can tell you this. It started, for example, from 6 cents a minute calling to Israel and about 5 cents a minute calling Europe.
Yep.
Right now it's 4 cents a minute to Israel, and I think you can call UK for 1 cent a minute.
That's pretty close to free. Val, thanks for your call. Chris Stern, sort that out for us. You know, right now a lot of people are going to Internet telephone use, and the rates are incredibly low, yet we're hearing from Mark and Ray here tonight that we're likely to see higher rates over the web in the future. What's up with that?
Well, we're talking about two different things. What the last caller was just talking about was Vonage, which is this innovative new company that has come out with an internet product that you add on top of your existing high-speed internet connection service. So you pay somewhere between $40 and $50 to a cable company or to a telephone company for high-speed service, and then you add Vonage on top of that. So his actual bill is probably closer to $70 or $80.
And who am I paying for the adding this on top of my cable modem?
Right. You send one connection. Check to your cable or telephone company for the high-speed internet connection, and another check for about $30 to Vonage for this software that essentially you use to call – to enables your phone to call anywhere of the world over the internet.
So long-term, is this my way out of the duopoly or not?
This is a potential path for competition, but Vonage has, I think, still less than 200,000 subscribers, and you're going to see a real crunch. Can a company like Vonage grow fast enough? I mean, there's 100 million people in this country, and it'd be interesting to see if Vonage can do this for everybody. I'm not quite sure. I don't think anybody else is sure. I just wanted to also point out that Ray mentioned things like WiMAX and other technologies. Those things are very speculative. Who knows what happens with those? They may pan out. They may not. The internet bubble burst 5 years ago based on hype technologies, and I'm sure that he's not buying into that similar hype. We've got what we're dealing with now is two wires into the home, and that's about it. And the other point I wanted to make is that the telephone companies have said our costs are we're getting beaten on our costs. We can't subsidize these other companies, but we really don't know how much the telephone companies how much they're paying or what their costs really are, because the FCC has never been able to audit the phone companies effectively. And the current chairman, Michael Powell, has essentially eviscerated the FCC's ability to audit the telephone companies. And 4 or 5 years ago, when the FCC was auditing the phone companies, they jumped in and stopped the audit.
Well, a lot more to learn as this all heads down the pike, but we've learned a lot tonight. I'm going to feel like a much more informed consumer anyway, even if my bill's going up. Chris Stern, thanks so much for being with us. Great having you.
Thank you.
Chris Stern writes for The Washington Post. Mark Cooper at the Consumer Federation of America, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Ray Gifford at the Progress and Freedom Foundation in Denver, Colorado, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Listeners, good luck with your phone bills. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. After the break, surprising details surrounding the September 11th terrorist plot are revealed by the 9/11 Commission. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States, better known as the 9/11 Commission, began its final round of public hearings this morning. Scheduled to last through tomorrow, the hearings are focusing on the 9/11 plot and the federal government's initial response to the attacks. Hours of testimony by FBI intelligence agents revealed details about the plot not previously known to the public, including evidence of an initial al-Qaeda plan to use 10 airplanes in an attack that would include FBI and CIA headquarters, as well as nuclear power plants and skyscrapers on the West Coast. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. Michael, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So here we are, more testimony and an incredible gusher of detail today. about plans, some of which came to fruition, some of which did not. Fill in the picture for us, Michael, about what we're learning as the commission rolls out its investigation.
Sure. Well, some new details about the 9/11 plot itself, including its origins and the sort of dreams of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this jihadist from Pakistan who had been working for years to figure out ways to for mass murder of Americans. And as you indicated, you know, the origins of the plot begin with his ideas about 10 hijackings, including one plane he wanted to hijack himself, kill all the male passengers, hold the women and children as ransom in order to make a political statement. Also, a lot of details about tensions within among the hijackers and within al-Qaeda itself about the 9/11 plot. We learned for the first time there were these tensions between Mohammed Atta and Ziad Jarrah, who was the Lebanese and most westernized of the hijackers, in which there was questions about whether Jarrah was committed enough to the plot. And then, most interesting, the later debate within al-Qaeda about whether to proceed with the operation, that bin Laden, some of bin Laden's top associates were fearful that this would provoke too much of a U.S. Reaction. Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, was against the operation, fearing the consequences for Afghanistan. Bin Laden himself wanted to move up the date to coincide with activities going on in the Palestinian uprising against Israeli occupation of the West Bank. All of these are sort of new details about the 9/11 plot we've never heard before. Of course, it is worth noting that most of them seem to come from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the 9/11 mastermind, who's been in custody since March of 2003. What we don't know is how much of what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to believe. And in fact, there was some questioning about how much corroboration there is for much of what he says. And the FBI and CIA and, witnesses indicated that, in fact, much of it was single-thread reporting. And leave aside the questions post Abu Ghraib about what the conditions, the circumstances of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's interrogations were. So is this some of this disinformation by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or just things he thinks interrogators want to hear after God knows what sort of interrogation techniques have been used?
So we've got to take this with a grain of salt and maybe more. With that proviso, dig into each of these elements here with us just a little bit. Initially, he's saying, or we're now told, 10 planes planned. Was that just a very early kind of blue sky hand-waving idea? How far did that go? You know, how late in the plotting and planning were there more planes and more targets reportedly on the table?
Well, blue sky proposal seems like a good way to describe it. It's just sort of musings of a jihadi who's clearly committed to figuring out ways to commit mass murder. But what's interesting is, you know, when it comes to targets, was the fourth plane that crashed in Pennsylvania intended for the White House, for the Capitol? It turns out there was a debate about which of the final targets that should be intended against. And as late as September 9th, there's a communication between Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib suggesting it was still an open question where they were going to fly and what they were intended to do. It is clear that that al-Qaeda was focused on the kind of, you know, really dramatic symbols that would resonate throughout the world. And so that the strike against the World Trade Center, the White House, the Pentagon, these were the kind of really dramatic attacks that would have an impact. I have to say, you know, it is interesting to me the political sensitivities of, or not sensitivities, but acuteness of,
yes,
of bin Laden, particularly in timing and trying to link things to what was going on in the on the global scene, especially in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. He originally wants to target time the attacks to coincide with Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount in the in 2000, an event that, as we know, triggered the Palestinian uprising within the occupied territories at the time that the Camp David Accords were still very much in play. This is during the Clinton administration. Bin Laden wanted to use that event as a pretext for the what became the September 11th attacks. Later, he wants to move up the attacks rather than delay them to coincide with the Palestinian, continued Palestinian attacks after the Camp David Accords have broken down.
To present these as a blow for the Palestinian cause.
Yeah.
And the nuance of deciding whether the plane goes into the White House or the Capitol Dome, do we get any of that?
I mean, clearly, I think there was some concern on Mohammed Atta's part that the White House would be too well protected, and that was one reason he was resisting the White House as being the final target. I think the al-Qaeda leadership felt that, or Bin Laden felt, that the White House would have a more symbolic impact even than the Capitol. But that's, to me, that seems like a pretty close call. Visually, the Capitol building is a pretty graphic symbol as well.
If that dome were crumpled, did the 9/11 Commission come to a conclusion about the confirmed target of the plane that went down to Pennsylvania?
No, it's still unclear. And I should say there are still a lot of unclear questions, unanswered questions relating to the plot that they haven't been able to answer. For instance, one that has always perplexed investigators is why did Mohammed Atta and one of his associates fly to Portland, Maine the night before the attacks and then fly back early that morning on the September 11th to catch the flight at Logan Airport, almost missing the flight. In fact, their bags didn't make it onto the flight. That was an enormous risk to take, and they weren't able to reach a conclusion as to why that trip was made. Some have speculated that perhaps they were meeting somebody who had come across the Canadian border. No answer for that. I mean, one FBI witness suggested that maybe it was simply to sort of not leave, to have as many of the hijackers come from different places, not to draw attention to themselves.
And the debate about whether or not to even proceed, is it clear how that was resolved?
No. Well, we do know. Well, what we do, we don't. We know. It's not clear what we know. We know what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has said is that there was this sort of debate within the
fear of the U.S. kickback.
Yeah, with Mullah Omar clearly fearing an American response. I have to say, these are the details of the plot. There was the earlier staff report that did have a lot of new details as well that have some political implications in the United States, especially shooting down claims about a collaborative relationship between al-Qaeda and the Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq. Some of the statements that the commission may conclusions reach about no credible evidence at all of a collaborative relationship between al-Qaeda and Iraq on launching attacks against the United States. This comes just 2 days after Vice President Cheney had once again asserted that there were long-established ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. So I think that's going to have some political resonance.
Let's stick with that one for a moment. I've got a piece of tape here. This is Douglas McKaken, a staff member on the 9/11 Commission, reading from the staff report on this point. Let's listen.
The senior Iraqi intelligence officer reportedly made 3 visits to Sudan and finally met with bin Laden in 1994. At that time, bin Laden is said to have requested space to establish training camps, assistance in procuring weapons, but Iraq apparently never responded. There have been reports that contacts between Iraq and al-Qaeda also occurred after bin Laden returned to Afghanistan, but they do not appear to have resulted in a collaborative relationship. And 2 senior bin Laden associates have adamantly denied any ties existed between al-Qaeda and Iraq. And so far, we have no credible evidence that Iraq and al-Qaeda cooperated on attacks against the United States.
Michael Isikoff, is this enough to put this to rest? Both the vice president and the president have said and suggested this week that this Saddam al-Qaeda tie was there. Are they going to say, well, look, the Iraqi intelligence officer was in Sudan talking with bin Laden. They had a conversation. Isn't that evidence?
Well, look, put it to rest, no, because I think it would barely be too politically dicey for the White House to finally concede that the Iraq al-Qaeda ties were not what they publicly presented, especially on the eve of this damning Senate Intelligence Committee report, which is going to talk about how the evidence suggesting Iraqi stockpiles of weapons
right.
of mass destruction were also mistaken. That really does cut a big chink of armor from the justification for the war in Iraq. One other noteworthy item there is in the second staff report on Mohammed Atta's movements. You know, there was the persistent claim that Mohammed Atta had traveled to Prague in the spring of 2001 and met with an Iraqi intelligence agent there.
Yes.
This is something that had been gotten a lot of currency within the Pentagon. Vice President Cheney had seemed to sort of leave open the question of maybe there was such a link. The staff report found that the meeting simply did not occur, that Mohammed Atta was very clearly in the United States at the time of the meeting. He's making cell phone calls in Florida. There's no evidence he left the country. So that's one more link that's been out there, that's been pushed by advocates or proponents of this al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein connection that the commission rejects.
Michael Isikoff, let's listen to just another bit of tape here. This is Vice Chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, talking with John Pistol, FBI Assistant Director for Counterterrorism and Counterintelligence, about al-Qaeda's capacity inside the United States today. It begins with Lee Hamilton posing a question.
What do we really know today about the capabilities, not the intent, the capabilities of al-Qaeda today to attack?
The short answer...
In the United States.
Yes. Yeah, the short answer is we know very little about their capability to attack. We know much more about their intent and know very little about their capability.
Do we know anything about their funding in the United States?
Yes. We have a number of ongoing investigations as well as some that have resulted in criminal prosecution of individuals who have been fundraisers here in the U.S. who are supporting al-Qaeda overseas. What we don't have is necessarily fundraising, which is supporting al-Qaeda here in the U.S. But we do have a number of individuals who have been in the public in terms of operatives who KSM has tasked with casing, for example, the Brooklyn Bridge.
Do we know anything about their recruitment in the United States?
Yes.
They clearly have an active campaign of recruitment.
Yes.
Is that fair?
That's correct.
Do we know anything about their command and control in the United States system? Can we identify a leader or leaders of al-Qaeda in the United States?
We have limited information on that.
So to sum up then, we have almost no information with regard to their capabilities in the United States. We know a little bit about their funding in the United States today. We know a little bit about their leadership today in the United States. We know very little, if anything, about their command and control. Do I sum it up correctly?
That's fairly accurate. We know, I would say, a little bit more than what you have said, but without going into more detail, it's hard to describe.
And there it is, Vice Chair Lee Hamilton talking with the FBI's Assistant Director for Counterterrorism, John Pistol. Michael Isikoff, how did the panel receive this? It sounds shocking on the face of it. They know the FBI knows there's an active campaign of recruitment, but they know very little about command and control and very little about al-Qaeda capability in the U.S. now.
Well, I'm afraid to anybody who follows this closely, it's just not much of a surprise. I mean, look, we've had this constant sort of back and forth about threat warnings and are we under greater threat? Are we not under greater threat? A couple of weeks ago, you know, Attorney General Ashcroft talks about credible multiple sources talking about an upcoming al-Qaeda plot in the United States. We certainly know that they would like to do that, but at the end of the day, there's precious little that the FBI knows about al-Qaeda operatives in the United States. What information it does have is exceedingly sketchy and incomplete. It leads to enormous mistakes. Look at the Brandon Mayfield case a few weeks ago, where a mistaken fingerprint, you know, leads to the arrest of a Muslim lawyer in Oregon on as being a possible collaborator in the Madrid bombings.
And he wasn't at all.
Completely false. So, I mean, this is the world we live in which.
Michael Isikoff, we're out of time, but thanks so much for joining us tonight. Michael Isikoff with Newsweek. On 9/11 hearings today, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.